Turn with me in your Bibles, please, to our first reading, Psalm 104. Psalm 104, verse 1, hear now the inerrant, infallible, and inspired Word of God. Bless the Lord, O my soul. O Lord my God, Thou art very great. Thou art clothed with honor and majesty, who coverest thyself with light as with a garment, who stretchest out the heavens like a curtain, who layeth the beams of his chambers in the waters, who maketh the clouds his chariot, who walketh upon the wings of the wind, who maketh his angels spirits, and his ministers a flaming fire, who hath laid the foundations of the earth, that it should not be removed forever. Thou coveredst it with the deep as with a garment, the waters stood above the mountains. At thy rebuke they fled, at the voice of thy thunder they hasted away. They go up by the mountains, they go down by the valleys unto the place which thou hast founded for them. Thou hast set a bound that they may not pass over, that they turn not again to cover the earth. He sendeth the springs into the valleys which run among the hills. They give drink to every beast of the field. The wild asses quench their thirst. By them shall the fowls of heaven have their habitation, which sing among the branches. He watereth the hills from his chambers. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of thy works. He causeth the grass to grow for the cattle, an herb for the service of man, that he may bring forth food out of the earth, and wine that maketh glad the heart of man, and oil to make his face to shine, and bread which strengtheneth man's heart. The trees of the Lord are full of sap, the cedars of Lebanon which he hath planted, where the birds make their nests. As for the stork, the fir trees are her house. The high hills are a refuge for the wild goats, and the rocks for the conies. He appointed the moon for seasons. The sun knoweth his going down. Thou makest darkness, and it is night, wherein all the beasts of the forest do creep forth. The young lions roar after their prey, and seek their meat from God. The sun ariseth, they gather themselves together, and lay them down in their dens. Man goeth forth unto his work, and to his labor until the evening. O Lord, how manifold are thy works! In wisdom hast thou made them all. The earth is full of thy riches. So is this great and wide sea, wherein are things creeping, innumerable, both small and great beasts. There go the ships. There is that Leviathan, whom thou hast made to play therein. These all wait upon thee, that thou mayest give them their meat in due season. That thou givest them, they gather. Thou openest thine hand, they are filled with good. Thou hidest thy face, they are troubled. Thou takest away their breath, they die, and return to their dust. Thou sendest forth thy spirit, they are created, and thou renewest the face of the earth. The glory of the Lord shall endure forever. The Lord shall rejoice in his works. He looketh on the earth, and it trembleth. He toucheth the hills, and they smoke. I will sing unto the Lord as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have any being, or while I have my being. My meditation of him shall be sweet. I will be glad in the Lord. Let sinners be consumed out of the earth, and let the wicked be no more. Bless thou the Lord, O my soul. Praise ye the Lord. May God add his blessing to the reading and hearing of his most holy word. So as we said earlier today, we noted that Psalm 104 and Psalm 103 have something in common. Bless the Lord, O my soul. And so we see that in the beginning and in the end of Psalm 104, like we did at 103. And so we are apt to say then that David is most likely the author of Psalm 104. and that these are to be considered as companion psalms. It is interesting that when we spoke of blessing the Lord in Psalm 103, that we spoke mostly of spiritual things. Now we turn in Psalm 104, blessing the Lord, and we think of God's providential workings. I think that would be a right distinction to make between these two psalms. So the first thing that I want to mention unto you is that in Psalm 104, we have several verses that are quoted in Hebrews chapter 1 that speak of the deity of Christ. So the writer in Hebrews picks some verses we've already seen out of Psalm 102, out of Psalm 104. And he applies these verses and relates them to the Lord Jesus Christ to show forth his superiority and deity, his Godhead, if you will, over the angels of God, over and then other material things. Jesus is set forth as the creator of all. He is set forth as greater than the angels in Hebrews chapter 1. So, we have then some great statements of God's majesty and honor, his separateness from the creation, and his rule over the creation. We hear these days about certain folks, cosmologists or so, that are saying things like that the universe, we might consider it as infinite. May I say, we don't want to go down that road. We want to understand that God is separate from his creation. If the creation is infinite, then we all become pantheists. We have to remember that. That if the creation is infinite, you cannot have two infinitudes. That then you're going to identify God with the creation, and pantheism is the result. That everything is a part of God, right? That God is everything and everything is God. No, we think of an expansive but finite universe and God as infinite and separate from his creation. And so there are statements that tend toward that understanding here at the beginning of Psalm 104, where it says, "Thou art clothed with honor and majesty, who covereth thyself with light as with a garment, who stretchest out the heavens like a curtain, who layeth the beams of his chambers in the waters, who maketh the clouds his chariot, who walketh upon the wings of the wind." So God is separate from his creation. He is not his creation. Creation does, what we learn here in Psalm 104, is that creation does the will of God. It is directed by God. It is an arm of his will, if you will, but it is not a part of him. And he is not a part of it. The creation can come and go, and God remains. Wasn't that what we heard in Psalm 102 last week, when it says that the heavens will be rolled up like a scroll, but thou dost endure? Okay? So, you need to keep that in mind. You need to keep your ears open for those kinds of statements that we hear from time to time from unbelieving and even well-meaning but misinformed Christian cosmologists who will say things like, "Well, you know, the universe might be infinite." No, it can't be. It can't be infinite. If it's infinite, then it's God. Okay? So keep that straight in your mind and remember that the Lord did stretch out the heavens, that the expanse of the heavens, that the depth, the breadth, the height of the universe is something that God stretched out. He encompasses it with his mind and with his power, but it is not him. So the psalmist reminds us that of God's separateness from his creation and his power over it. And then he's going to go on to talk about God's rule over the creation. And that really does take up the rest of the psalm with a few notable exceptions. And I want to make sure I mention them to you. But notice, first of all, we talk about the flood. That God laid the foundations of the earth that it should not be removed forever. And he covered it with the deep as with a garment, and the waters stood above the mountains. And then at thy rebuke they fled, at the voice of thy thunder they hasted away. Right? So that God divided This is speaking about the creation, and it's just another poetic way of saying that God divided the waters from the waters with land. There were waters above and waters beneath at the original creation. I have no idea what that looked like. I don't know. I know what the Bible tells me, that there were waters above and waters beneath. I'm not going to develop a silly cosmology for the Old Testament saints and say, well, they believed that the heavens were blue because they were water. Well, the Bible doesn't say that. That's just the postulations of unbelievers. It says there were waters above, waters beneath, and the Lord gathered the waters into places and caused dry land to appear and separated the waters from the waters. Okay. He was there. Let's take his testimony on that. Right? He was there. So we can take his testimony. So they fled at the Lord's rebuke, at the voice of his thunder, they hasted away. They go up by the mountains, they go down by the valleys into the place which thou hast founded for them. And then verse 9, we hear that thou hast set a bound that they may not pass over, that they may not turn again to cover the earth. Of course, there we're remembering the second creation, if you will, right? Where God started over, essentially, and then gave the same charge to Noah that he gave to Adam at the beginning. Fill the earth, replenish it, and rule over it. All right, so now we come to verse 10. And in verse 10, the psalmist breaks out into a chorus of God's providence over so very many things, that everything belongs to him, that he disposes it according to his will, and that he does so in his kindness to man and beast. We might speak for a moment about the concept of common grace. We touched on it a little bit earlier today when we said that grace is not in things. It's not in things. So the goodness of God that floods the earth, and it certainly does. The sunshine, we see sunshine out there today. We've had rain earlier this morning. We have had our plants growing. Some of us enjoy gardening out in the backyard, and then we partake of the goodness of the things that spring forth from the earth, whether that's meat, you know, flesh, or whether it's plant food, whatever it is. We enjoy that. And not just believers enjoy that. Everybody enjoys that. Sometimes we get confused. We think that grace is in things, and so God is being gracious to unbelievers in that sense. And I want to make sure that we get that straight in our minds, because all of the goodness that is showered upon those who will remain in their unbelief really doesn't do them any good. And in the end, it makes them more guilty and heaps up wrath. And that's not grace. We don't want to think grace is in things. Grace is in the disposition of God toward men to give them salvation in Jesus Christ, such that the good things that they receive from him may be subdued in service to God. Now that's grace. We even find from the Apostle Peter that if you do well and suffer for it, this is, literally in the original it says, this is grace from God. Even deprivations, even what we would consider bad things, can be grace to those who belong to Christ. So it's not the carnal disposition of things that makes them gracious. Like we said earlier today, then we would have to confess that men like Elon Musk and Bill Gates and others are blessed by God beyond imagining, and they are not. If they were blessed by God, they would love Christ, because that's the first and foremost grace, is implanting in our hearts a love for Christ and his word, such that if the Lord should please to make rich, as he did Abraham, and to advance as he did Joseph, that those tools and those skills and those places and those stations would be subdued to God for his glory. That's what grace is. Grace is not in things. Things are indifferent. God can use them to curse as well as to bless. So we are going to hear in Psalm 104 about what I think, more careful speech requires, and that is we're going to hear about the common goodness of God. We want to reserve grace for God's saving works. We want to talk about God's goodness to all in that He is a good and kind God. And all we need to do is just pause for a moment to think about Psalm 104. First of all, let's think of the noise that rises up to God from the earth every day. What kind of noise rises up to God from the earth? Is it a foul noise or is it a sweet noise? Well, it's foul. What did God say in Genesis chapter 6, where the thoughts of men were only evil continually? He said, "My spirit is grieved." It's not a sweet sound that rises up from the earth to God. There is some sweetness that rises up. We spoke earlier of the covenant that God made with Noah, that He put a bound about the sea. Interestingly, in that same covenant, that covenant is made as a response by God to Noah offering a sacrifice. And there's something ascending up to God that is a sweet savor. What is that? That's the savor of Christ. 2 Corinthians chapter 2. So, we have God's common goodness, but it's different from His common grace. The grace comes through Christ. The sweetness comes through Christ. So now we think of the noise that comes up off the world, the ugly cacophony of sin, of profaneness, of commonness, of a complete want of holiness and rebellion and shaking of fist against God. And that is rising up from the earth every day and is heard in the halls of heaven. And God, for His part, continues to do good to men and to give them rain and to give them sunshine and to give them beds and to give them food and to give them far beyond what they have deserved. And we might be inclined to say, well, yeah, but there are people that suffer mightily in this world. That is true. And we don't deny that. But that suffering that they endure is better than what they deserve. Let's remember that, too. Let's put things in their biblical cast. What do we truly deserve? We deserve everlasting separation from the comfortable presence of God and most grievous torments in soul and body without intermission in hellfire forever. Period. End of dessert. That's what we deserve. And so even if people suffer in human terms mightily in this world, and they do, there are those who suffer with deprivation and want and starvation and hunger. They suffer under oppression. They suffer under military oppression and injury and all kinds of calamity and sin that takes place all over this world. And yet every single one of those instances is better than what we as a race deserve. And so we still might see some goodness of God in it. If someone suffers all of their life under the difficult providence of God, and in the end, hears of the sweetness of Jesus Christ, they will count all of that as nothing compared to the sweetness and joy of knowing Christ and spending eternity with Him. So we have to get ourselves straight in all of this. We have to think rightly in this, because we're so apt, aren't we, to think to the left or to the right and to judge things by the carnal appearances of them rather than the spiritual truth that God reveals in His Word. So we're going to hear about some wonderful providential things that God does and some other things where God withdraws His hand, they die and they return to their dust, right? Doesn't the psalmist say that as well? And all of that is under the providential hand of God. Now, when we say the providential hand, we don't mean to draw back one whit from God's intention and purpose. God has intention. God has purpose in everything. I have a very dear friend of mine. I've known him for 40 years now. And he's a wonderful, I think, brother in the Lord. And he and I will go round and round and have this discussion. And he'll ask me, "Do you really think that God controls everything in this world?" Yeah, absolutely. Everything. Yes. Yes, there's not a square centimeter upon which a drop of rain falls that God has not determined that it should fall there. There's not a grain of dust that rises up and falls down on the prairie out here that God hasn't determined that. Yes, everything. And this is the genius, the brilliance, the omniscience of God at play that we see. He doesn't believe that. One day I think he will. This passage teaches us, that all these things are the moving hand of God. And so when we say his providential hand, we don't mean to say anything less about determination. God determines it all. Every bit of it. This is not a quote unquote bare permission. We don't give human beings a break for bare permission. Why would we give God a break for bare permission, right? Okay. All right. So let's go ahead and look at a couple of particulars. That's the thesis of the psalm. Notice that, first of all, there is so much kindness of God, a common goodness that God has to all men. He causes the grass to grow for the cattle, the herb for the service of man, that he may bring forth food out of the earth, wine that maketh glad the heart of man, and oil to make his face to shine, and bread which strengtheneth man's heart. We had an opportunity to reference those earlier at the Lord's Supper. The trees of the Lord are full of sap, the cedars of Lebanon, which he hath planted, where the birds make their nests. As for the stork, the fir trees are her house. If he cares for the birds, Jesus says, how much more shall he not care for you, O ye of little faith? You're worthy, you're worth more than many sparrows, Jesus says. So these are wonderful things to think about. When we talk about the good and kind providence of God, we remember that God takes care of his people as well. But I do want to show you something here that I think we're, this is a timely thing. That's why I bring it up. Notice in verse 20, thou makest darkness, and it is night, wherein all the beasts of the forest do creep forth. The young lions roar after their prey and seek their meat from God. The sun ariseth, they gather themselves together and lay them down in dens. Man goeth forth unto his work and to his labor until the evening. It is a providential gift of God to give man his labor. Solomon will tell us, let a man rejoice in his labor. It's the gift of God. Now, if labor is the gift of God, then there is no authority in heaven or in earth that can rightly keep you from it in its lawful course. Let's remember that. So that when we have civil magistrates today, and they are saying this, you stay home and we'll pay you to stay home, to do nothing. The believing response to that is, thank you, sir. Let me work. This is God's gift to me. The labor that God has put into my hands, whereby I might have for my family, for a tithe, and to give to him that's in need, is God's gift to me, and you cannot rightly take it from me. Let's remember that labor is God's gift. Not gift is God's labor, but labor is God's gift to mankind. We live in an age where we are all too ready to receive something for nothing. And you've heard me say this before, I'll say it again. I'm not afraid of saying it because it's good Bible doctrine, that something for nothing is always going to harm you, or most always. It's not going to do you any good in this world. If someone tells you, you stay home and I'll pay you to stay home, or as has been going on for decades now in our country, farmers, you don't grow something and I'll pay you not to grow something. What does that mean? It means that they are depriving us of something that we need very much. And that is meaningful labor to be serviceable to God and man. This is God's gift. In all of these providential gifts here in Psalm 104, what do we see? Man goeth forth to his work and unto his labor until the evening. O Lord, how manifold are thy works. In wisdom thou hast made them all. The earth is full of thy riches. O my dear brothers and sisters, hear this. Your labor. Now, some of us labor not for money. We labor for others. We serve. That's okay. Others have a calling where they're providing for others, and they must rise up and receive remuneration for their calling. And that's good too. But to say there is nothing required, and you will be taken care of, is to rob mankind of the gift of God. Learn to work. Young men, I say this with all seriousness. Get yourself a good trade. Get yourself a good education or a good skill so that when you are ready, you can find a wife, have a family, and you can provide. Don't do what I have so often, with tears, sat with others who have gotten into their 40s or 50s and not able to provide for their family because they never learned a skill. They never got their education. They never availed themselves of the wonderful gift of labor. We have people today telling us, or we hear people saying that, I only want to work a few days a week or a few days a month. And if I can provide for myself and my family by working a few days a month, that's what I want to do. Really? Well, how much of God's gift do you want, then? How much? What does the Bible say here? That man plies his craft until the evening. Not one or two evenings a month. But 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. And the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work. That's God's order. I know I've gone a little long on this particular topic. But it is because, and I agree, I don't think this man is a Christian. At least, he doesn't have a covenant Christian profession. He may be a nominal Christian, and he may have some good things to say. And I think he said some very good things. He has said that we have declared war on work in our country. And I think that's correct. I think that's a good analysis of our culture. And our government has aided and abetted that war and provided for it by paying people to do nothing but stay home. Whenever someone does that to you, remember that they design to do you harm. Did you hear me? They design to do you harm. The prize patrol is hurting people. Now think with me on that. Look at what it says here. This is God's gift. This is part of God's manifold wisdom to the human race. That we work, and that by that work, we learn to make a way in this world under His hand and with His blessing. Okay, so now we move on from that point. Everybody's saying, thankfully. So we move on from that point now, and we go to that the Lord has provided the various venues of the earth for that. So the ships go in this sea. That's where they seek their food. Then there are others, large animals that live in that sea, and smaller animals. And they gather, and God opens His hand to them, and they are filled with good. And then He hides His face, and they are troubled, and He takes away their breath, and they die and return to their dust. And let's remember this, and I hope we burn this as well into our collective thinking here. And that is that we don't say good things come from God and bad things come from the devil. We don't say that. What does the psalmist say here? God opens His hand and they flourish, and He closes His hand and they die. Where does the psalmist lay the responsibility? Right at God's feet, right where it belongs. This is part of God's sovereign administration. The devil is God's devil. So let's remember that as well. That as Job said, so must we say, shall I receive good from the hand of the Lord and not evil? Of course, that's a rhetorical question. The answer is, I shall receive both. Very important. Very, very solid, very important doctrine here. Okay, so then finally in verse 31, the psalmist starts his ramp up to the end. The glory of the Lord shall endure forever. The Lord shall rejoice in His works. He looks on the earth and it trembles. He touches the hills and they smoke. And what is the proper response of His people then? Verse 33. I will sing unto the Lord as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have my being. So that is in times of greatness, in times of advancement, in times of drawing back, in times of deprivation, in times of ease, and in times of trouble. I will sing praise to the Lord as long as I live. Notice, my praise to Him shall be sweet. My meditation of Him shall be sweet. And I will be glad in the Lord. This is a commitment. It doesn't go as far as a vow, but it is a statement of commitment. I will be glad in the Lord. All right, so then 35, let sinners be consumed out of the earth, let the wicked be no more. And then, bless thou the Lord, O my soul. Like we began, so we end. Praise ye the Lord. Let's stand and call upon the Lord in prayer.